Oh, that's.
Right. Hello, everyone. I will go around and say hi. Starting with, and it's all just kind of random who shows up first on Zoom, I think. Betty, Mark, Ellen, Jeff, Dave, Jim, Shoketsu, Susan, Karen, Paul, Jinryu, Marv, Tyler, Erica, Joyce, and then who else is with you?
My husband, Doug.
Hi, Doug. And Raven, Yashitoki, Drew, and Ruth Ann. All right. So, in terms of announcements, I can't think of anything in particular. Any other announcements people should make? Jinryu.
Yes, I just wanted to remind everybody that as of tomorrow, we are halfway through our fundraiser. And we had an original goal of $5,000, which we have blown past. So our new goal is $10,000. Right now, we're a little over $7,000. If you remember, then you would have gotten a letter announcing this about 2 weeks ago. But if you're not a member, it's just because we didn't have your contact information, but we really want everyone. Hi, Ken. We really want everyone to feel like they can contribute if they can afford to. So this is really about, on the one hand, practical things like paying the rent on the building we hope to go back to, like paying Domio for being our teacher. But it's also about spiritual things and taking care of something, in my case, taking care of something that I love, a community and a teacher that I really care about. So if you feel the same way, please give to our fundraising campaign. You go to the website, you click donate here, and it's really simple. Or you can send Domio a check at the mailing address on the website, and that's it. Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you to everyone who has given already. Any questions about anything that's coming up? Okay. All right. Welcome back to Ken, who is now in Hawaii. And he's not in prison, he's just in quarantine. All right. So we are continuing with our Nine Fields of Zen practice class. Let's see. So, just by a little bit of way of review, once again, if anybody can get the link to the nine fields and put it in the chat, that would be awesome. So the nine fields, if anybody here is not familiar, it's a way of organizing our thoughts about practice that I came up with. And there's nine different fields of practice, and it's not of Zen practice, and it's not a checklist that you have to, make sure you do all of them. It's more of meant to stimulate your imagination and creativity, to think of all the different areas of your life where you can manifest practice. So that includes Zazen and Dharma study, which we've already talked about. We're also going to be talking about precepts and opening the heart, working in relationships and with metta practice, and connecting with the ineffable, developing our sense of the divine and what is greater. There is karma work and yoho, that according with the Dharma in everyday life. So there's many different fields of practice. So we're just going through each one. We've already covered Zazen in Dharma study. And last week, we talked about cultivating insight, this third field. And we decided to make it into a two-class thing, because by the time we got to the end last week, we realized there was so much to talk about, we would just continue it. So if you are curious at all, on the Bright Within website, under resources, recordings, and then the classes and discussions, you'll find the past classes that you can pull up and either watch the Zoom or listen to, if you want to go back and do that. Plus, if you follow that link that was put in the chat, my podcast website has a lot of suggested podcast episodes to listen to for each field. So let's see. This week, continuing with cultivating insight or knowing for ourselves, which means working on a personal, direct, experiential insight into the deeper truths of the teaching. Before I begin, are there any questions simmering out there just about stuff that we've talked about in past classes or the nine fields in general, anything like that? And you are welcome throughout to kind of raise your hand. And if you want to do it Zoom style, there's a reactions button at the, usually if it's a computer, the bottom of the screen. And if you click it, there's a little thing that says raise hand and a little hand like that. And if you do that, then you can just leave that up and I will see it. Or you could do it the old fashioned way and raise your hand or unmute yourself. So any questions before I begin? About stuff we've already covered. If you think of something, feel free. Okay, so last week I talked about the meaning and importance of insight in Buddhism. How the significance of aha, you know, I see it, I perceive the truth which can be liberating, has, you know, that's the Buddha's original story. Is he goes on a spiritual search, he has a moment, you know, he has a night where he achieves enlightenment, and you know, he sees the answer to his burning spiritual question. And we talked about how, you know, there's all different ways to have those aha moments. Sometimes they're big, sometimes they're small, but they're all valuable and they're all significant. So it's not just a matter of, you know, have you experienced enlightenment or not? Nope. Yes. It's not none of this is a binary thing where you're just, we have little ahas every day. And throughout the course of our practice, we have significant moments of insight, shift in perception and understanding. And then we talked about what we want to awaken to. So, and then this week we're going to go into the how do we cultivate insight. So that was the big part we didn't get to last week. But as a very, very brief review, in terms of the how we hold insight in Buddhism, I said that last week that there were two take-home lessons about that. So one is the truth sets you free. So this is a very significant aspect of Buddhism. It's not a deity that sets us free. It's not other spirits or forces. It's the truth. If we are simply able, it's not simple, but if we are able to see reality clearly, we will know what is best to do. We will be drawn to what is best to do if we see things clearly. So the truth sets us free. And if we see reality clearly, we will turn away from suffering. But a lot of times the reason we're causing suffering for ourselves and others is I like to say, we're looking for love in all the wrong places. We're trying to achieve happiness, but we don't recognize, in what ways we're undermining our own happiness and that of others, or inhibiting it. So, take home lesson two was that there are different degrees of knowing. So this is, again, to get us away from that idea that insight or enlightenment or whatever is a binary thing. So I used an example of knowledge of New York. You might have a knowledge of New York City that's based on reading and studying. Maybe you just read. And then maybe you have a greater knowledge if you see some photos or some videos or some movies. If you travel there, you're going to have a deeper understanding. If you stay there for a couple of years, you're going to have a deeper understanding. If you live there for 30 years, you have a deeper understanding. So it's a, you know, there's, and certainly when we're talking about the reality of human life, that's at least as complex as New York City. So there's degrees of knowing, which I find comforting myself. So it's not a binary thing. We can become more and more and more familiar, learn more and more. So then in terms of what we want to awaken to, and, you know, this is certainly open for argument, but I wanted to boil it down to the essential from the Buddhist and particularly Zen point of view. What is it particularly important for us to have a personal understanding of, a personal knowledge and direct experience of? We don't have to, you know, have a understanding of every teaching that has ever been presented in Buddhism or master every practice. But fundamentally, there's, the way that I'm framing it right now anyway, two things. One is you need to understand suffering. Suffering and release from suffering. So dukkha is the word that we use for this. So this is the Buddha's Four Noble Truths, his very first teaching, which are not, the Four Noble Truths are not just things for us to accept and go, oh yeah, 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 I get it. I you know, they're not a creed for us to adopt. They are things to be investigated in our own direct experience. So the first is essentially life is marked by dissatisfactoriness, stress, anxiety, suffering. These are different translations of dukkha. And it's much better to face this fact than it is to deny it or run away from it, grasp after pleasure, hoping to avoid it. It's, you know, it, and it, and this is why sometimes Buddhism is said to be pessimistic, right? Because it says, hey, look, life is tough. Inevitably, even if it's great right now, it's going to be tough at some point. Everybody experiences old age, disease, loss, death, all of that. So first of all, we acknowledge that. And second, to explore and know for ourselves that our experience of life is largely dependent on the state of our own mind. So it's not just a matter of we are visited by fortune or misfortune, but how we experience all of that is enormously dependent on the state of our own mind and heart. How do we perceive the world and what's happening in ourselves and our relationship to it? And then the third, kind of analogous to the Four Noble Truths, my gist of them. So no matter what happens to you, you have choice in how you respond. So in terms of that, you know, your experience of life matters a great deal depending on your own state of your heart and mind. And then the third is you can do something about that. There are things that you can do to influence your own state of mind and body that can lead to relief from dukkha. And importantly, we say there's a difference between pain and dukkha. Pain, emotional pain, psychological pain, even that is just part of life. We're not going to escape that. But But dukkha is what we add to it. Dukkha is the part we can let go. So, you know, the classic example is like there's a, you're riding along in your boat and a boat strikes you from the side and you go, "Why did somebody hit me in their boat?" You turn over and you see the boat is empty. Right? Like, in the one hand, if that was a negligent person who hit you with their boat, now you would feel one way. But then when you see it's an empty boat, you feel a different way. So that, like, the extra angst that we add to that because of our interpretation of the situation is the dukkha. So we need to understand that from our own personal experience. And last week I went into an example of how you might kind of on a psychological level do this in the course of your own life, given you have a difficult relationship problem, and how you explore that source of suffering and explore how to let it go. And then the second thing is the true nature of self, and by extension all things, is empty of inherent, enduring, independent self nature. And these two insights are not, they're not separate. Certainly seeing the emptiness of self can help us let go of suffering. And as we let go of the aspects of our mind and body that cause extra suffering, we notice, huh, I guess they're not as real as I thought. So they kind of, you know, they can feed, the insights can feed each other. And just by review, emptiness, we say self nature is empty. But it's empty, it's not a negative nihilistic thing to say. It's empty of something we expect to be there. We assume we have an inherent, enduring, independent self-essence. We just assume we must. It feels like we do. And we say this, there's not, it's not really there. So the self is not, there's not that there's no self. It's that the self is not what we think. The self is boundless. The self is not ultimately separate from all other things and all other life. And that is good. That is okay. At first, it sounds scary that self is empty. But it's actually a very liberating, wonderful thing to realize. So anyway, okay, that's the quick review. And then on to how do we go about trying to cultivate personal, direct, experiential insight of these things. So any questions before I move on to that part? Raven.
I don't know. This may seem like a weird question, but is crying and is it like indulging in suffering, or should you be more focused on just focusing on your breath or something?
That is a good question. That is a very good question. I guess what I think about is that it really kind of depends. And then essentially we ask ourselves as we're experiencing something like that, you know, what is going on? What is going on in our mind? Because sometimes there's just, the self is just processing pain or loss, and the tears just come, and that's just what's going on, you know? So our practice is to simply be present with what is going on. So actually sometimes our tendency might be to like suppress that kind of thing because we don't want to feel it. So it sometimes may be a time to do that. But on the other hand, we could be I mean, I imagine other people relate to this. You know, you have a source of misery and angst, and you just kind of wallow in it. You know, you just kind of sit and go over and over and over the hurtful and terrible things and think about what might have been. And you know, you can definitely generate more tears through that process. So it's an interesting question. So let's see. I have a
Thank you for
list.
answering it. It's very helpful.
I have a list of how to cultivate insight. So I'll go more deeply into each one and I'll kind of pause and hopefully, you know, you'll think of questions along the way. But I'll just give you kind of an overview. And one is I'm going to talk about how this field, which I call cultivating insight, in a Theravadan or original Buddhist formulation, this field probably would have been called mindfulness. But mindfulness in a traditional sense, not in a modern sense, it means, you know, paying attention to your breath and this moment and staying in this moment non-judgmentally, and that is a wonderful practice. And really, that's actually like in the Buddhist sense, that's mindfulness of the body, or perhaps mindfulness of sensations. But in the traditional Buddhist sense, you then apply mindfulness to all kinds of stuff, states of mind, you know, things that cause suffering, the teachings themselves. So you turn that attention toward these things. So I'll go more into that. So in a sense, this is practicing mindfulness in the traditional Buddhist sense. The second thing is I just want to talk a little bit about how practice in all the other nine fields supports cultivating insight. So they all kind of feed back and support one another. And I'll talk about how that is. And then the third and the fourth. So the third is great doubt, cultivating the willingness and desire to know for ourselves, to honor and to learn to value and identify what we call, you know, great, capital G, capital D, great doubt. And then the fourth is great faith. So a trust in the practice that we can explore these deeper questions and not lose ourselves, not get lost in despair or confusion or something, that the practice will support us as we make this exploration. And then the fifth, I'm calling cultivating spiritual urgency, which and I have a podcast where I talked about a it's not a very commonly talked about Theravadan practice, Theravadan teaching, but there's these paired emotions of Samvega and Passada, and Samvega is a spiritual urgency, a kind of discontent, and then Passada is that faith that I was talking about. That's, you know, a kind of a calm equanimity that, like, look, I got the practice will support me, it's good. So, all right, so starting with practicing mindfulness. So in the classic sense, mindfulness means turning the mind towards subjects and looking deeply. So, in a classic sense, they talked a lot about calming the mind first and gaining the powers of concentration and stuff like that. But in life, generally, not always, but generally speaking, you have the concentration you need for tasks or issues or matters that are of great concern to you. Like, it's a natural thing to concentrate on something that's kind of abstract and seems irrelevant and whatever, that can be tougher, right? Concentrate on a math problem you don't get, but to concentrate on somebody you just fell in love with, or concentrate on something you're excited about happening or something like that. But then we don't even think, you don't even have to concentrate on that, but we're doing the same thing. We're paying attention to something. And so in a sense, in Zen, we say like this concentration can happen a little more naturally, kind of in the process of identifying what it is that we're going to pay attention to. So basically in our practice, what I like to encourage people to do, and I'm not sure if I get this across, but is to regard every issue that arises in our everyday lives, every problem. And by that, I mean, not like there's a problem out there to be solved, but that problem's causing a problem in here. Or for some reason there's angst or depression or anxiety, or there's longing or hollowness or boredom or constriction or inhibition or any of those things. That these are all opportunities to awaken. These are all signs of deeper spiritual issues. And I hesitate to say issues in a way, because that sounds bad, right? Like, you have issues. But they are, we all have them. We all have fear of death, fear of loss, a longing to belong, a longing to know that we are okay, a longing to know what we should do and how we should respond. So these questions are just natural human questions. And part of our practice is learning to be comfortable with these things, to admit that we have these deeper questions or issues, obstacles, and to look at them as opportunities, or sometimes I call them koans, an opportunity to engage this. It's a problem that you can't just, doesn't have just a simple binary, linear, logical answer to. It's an answer that we have to actually live. So I just wanted to briefly share. This is also on my podcast with the teachings of the five wisdom energies. So one of the ways that this is Vajrayana Buddhism, not Theravada Buddhism, Vajrayana Buddhism looks at this human response that we have to life. So that the theory goes that each of us intuits emptiness. We have a sense like things are just not quite how they're supposed to be. I can't really grasp anything. And everything's changing. I'm probably gonna get old and die someday. Ooh, you know, it's uncomfortable. So we intuit this emptiness of self, but we don't fully comprehend it. So it becomes an object of fear instead of liberation. And there's different ways that this fear manifests. And so the five wisdom energies, the idea is that given our karma, there's five different ways this manifests, and that identifies the kind of issues we have, but it also identifies the kind of like gateway of liberation that we have. So there's particular ways to deal with each of these koans. So we may have a fear of annihilation. So we still have this sense, this delusion of a substantial self. And when we sense this impermanence, we feel under threat. Or we feel nothingness, meaninglessness, just a nihilistic void. If the self is empty, there's nothing. Or we fear isolation. So if there's no one here, then I'm not connected. I'm isolated from all things. Or I'm insubstantial. So some these kind of the teaching itself fleshes out what the differences between these are, but insubstantial. So you kind of have a sense of self, but you have a like this being can be undermined or changed or disappears. So then we want to make the self as we want to, you know, accumulate as much as we can so that we're as have as much staying power as possible. Or we fear groundlessness, that we have nowhere to stand and nowhere to respond from in an effective way. So each of these kinds of reactions, I mean, these are, if we look down below, even the most mundane kind of issue, right? Maybe you're really annoyed, like I am, by inconsiderate people. Just people who, like, I live on a busy street. People just throw stuff out, the garbage out the window of their car, and then I have to pick it up. And there's this little part of me like, and if I look, that you might just think, well, that's something that I just need to work on and get over because, you know, that's indulging anger or something like that, right? So, but that's working at it at a kind of a karmic level, which that's part of our practice as well, is just trying to work on our habits, work on our the ways that our mind works and try to become a better person. But fundamentally, when you go further down, you know, the question, but the issue below the issue, below the issue, below the issue, and you get to this sense where there's just this scared self. It's just this self that's trying to, like, I need to control things or everything's going to get out of hand. And then I'll lose control and everything will be lost. So it's kind of a, that green energy Buddha family fear of groundlessness. And then we wrestle with that question at a very deep level, groundlessness. What would it mean to feel safe? What would it mean to feel unthreatened? And we can, through awakening through cultivating insight, we can free ourselves from that fear. So that's the gist of that. That there's a lot there. Any questions or thoughts or things that you're further intrigued by there? So I did do a Dharma talk on May 30th, 2021, and the recording is on the Bright Ways End website. So that's resources. Talks. And if you look back to May 30th, I call it ennobling our lives by engaging all problems as koans. So if you're intrigued at all by that, there's a little more there. Ken.
Thank you. With this insight and confronting and looking into our suffering and such, I just spent months confronting my fears and proving them to be rooted in delusion, because my biggest fear is that I won't be able to handle a situation and I will just completely fail and fall flat. So I just put myself through a 3-month ringer of problem after problem after problem, and I'm still here, but the lesson wasn't learned. The goal would have been for me to say, I have no need to fear this thing. Look at what I have done. It's not in there or here or. So, how does one maintain or or create that sort of harmonic resonance, whatever you want to call it, that carries over to reduce your dukkha, even when you know better, or you've learned better, or you've proven yourself.
I think that's a, I don't know. When you're describing that, it makes me think about what I was talking about, like the degrees of knowing, of, you know, like degrees of knowing about New York, that whatever you did over the last few months did inform you. You did learn something. You know, there's part of you going like, I don't know about that fear. I don't know if that fear is legitimate, but I still feel it. You know, so you're learning something. But I think what is so helpful about Dharma practice and about particularly this field, and if we can use the continuity of Sangha and, you know, discussing things and meeting with teachers and whatever, if we can kind of keep our eye on the ball, that's the tricky part, is that we get distracted by stuff in life, right? And we're like, oh yeah, back a few years ago, I was working on that whole, like, you know, self trust and acceptance thing. Oh yeah, whatever happened to that? So we try to keep the momentum up. And then just, I guess it's like we, ultimately, we're not going to find the answer if we give up. So we have to be like, God damn it. Just like you're saying, like, well, why did I do all that stuff? And I still don't feel liberated from this thing. Why is that? And the rest of the world, the non-practice world, is going to tell you, well, you know, I mean, just accept things the way they are. And, you know, like, don't make yourself overwrought with that whole, like, trying to figure this out. But we say, keep trying to figure it out, but not figuring it out in the normal way, like just analyzing things over and over. And who knows how you're going to figure it out. But to not lose that faith, which I'm going to talk about later, like, I do believe that I can figure it out, because I figured that thing out before. That was really cool. That was liberating. And, you know, this teacher says I can figure it out. And these ancestors that wrote these teachings said I can figure it out. And I know this guy in my Sangha, and he seems to have really figured it out. Like, you just like, damn it. And you just keep on wrestling with it. And you lose track of the issue. Sometimes it's not like from the very beginning I thought, here's my problem and now I'm going to solve it. It's not like it remained some kind of clear overarching question. It just ended up being more like there's one Chan writing, I think it's like you've swallowed a hot iron ball. Is that what it is? I trust Mark to remember. Mark or Marv?
Red hot.
Red hot iron ball. And you just can't be comfortable until you deal with it. And so in some ways, you know, this invites some angst, but, you know, it's what Buddhism promises is there really is a resolution. There really is a way of liberation and greater understanding. And it often comes down to something, it just ends up being so personal. That pivotal insight which frees us. So a lot of times we, you know, I was saying that the enlightenment is not binary, but there is a moment, and this is like in some traditions, including ours, we call it Kensho, where somebody sees the nature of self in a, like, a particular way. Like, maybe you realize New York is a real place you can go to, or maybe it's when you first set foot in it, you know, it's like it becomes very different. You still have a lot to learn, but you never quite go back to the same level of self bondage. So, you know, and I still have one more podcast to do about my own path, right, where I talk a little bit more about some of these little moments that I had of just like, huh, I do not have to compare myself to other people. I can be completely worthwhile and just like everybody else. And it, you know, for me, that was a really beautiful pivotal thing that changed me forever, even though, you know, it doesn't sound that amazing, but it was. All right. Going on then to a little bit about how the practice in the other fields prepares us and opens us for this cultivating insight. So we talked a little bit last week about how our Shikan Taza, even though our Soto Zen themeless sitting is not mindfulness meditation, it's not insight meditation, it's not taking a topic or a teaching or something and putting our lens of concentration on it and trying to see our way into it. I mean, we can do that. You can do some of that. That is fine. It's not against the rules. But, you know, then we do recommend that you do some themeless sitting. You do some of this Shikan Taza, which is not trying to figure anything out at all. But, you know, what this does is open us. It prepares us. It's like Kyogen saying that we're making a lap for samadhi. Samadhi is this kind of non-dual state of awareness that comes upon us sometimes and allows us just, you know, it's like the clouds part and we see how things are. Not in a dramatic, like, I have used my powers of mindfulness to uncover this truth. It's just the clouds part and there it is. So Shikan Taza helps us, helps prepare us, make us more susceptible to insight. And then Dharma study, as we talked about a couple weeks ago, like we're doing tonight, you know, it challenges the ideas we already have. So we may think, I don't need to do Dharma study. And the idea of accumulating more knowledge or reading more stuff doesn't necessarily appeal. But in a way, we don't know the assumptions that we have until we encounter the teachings that challenge them. I mean, we might find them out, but it's a pretty broad and reliable. And then the Dharma study will also plant new seeds, new words and ideas, not that are supposed to become concrete, but that give us a new way to frame our experience that helps us along. And then further on with the compassion fields of practice and the skillful action fields of practice, you know, these are opportunity after opportunity to practice with suffering, to practice letting go of self. So this is the, you know, we enact all of this as well. And as we enact it, we gain some insight as well. You know, when we're trying to work on the precept of do not indulge anger. What is it? Do not contrive reality for the self. And when you practice with letting go of anger and you also turn that lens of mindfulness on the whole process, you can see, you have an opportunity to see the emptiness of self. Because it just seems so real. Nothing seems more real than anger. Ah, this thing. And I couldn't just stop being angry. Are you kidding? I can't just. But you can. And if you find a way to do it, you realize, oh, wow, there's a whole lot of other aspects of self that might not be as concrete and real as I thought they were. And another way to put all of this is that the samadhi power and karma relationship, legs of our practice. So the samadhi power is what we're doing with shikantaza, trying to just let go of our mental map of reality, our personal narrative, dramatic narrative, and open up to other ways of seeing. So that's samadhi power, but we also work on karma. We also work on our relationships and our habits and precepts and bodhisattva activity, and they're complementary. So a lot of times, this is one of the greatest examples, I think, is, you know, if we are working on opening our heart, the one of the fields of practice, and we are not just trying to open our heart to other people, but we're also trying to open our heart toward ourselves and work on self-acceptance and healing, that can have a profound effect on even our zazen. So that was definitely the case for me, where, you know, I'm trying to sit and I'm going to lots of meditation retreats, and my zazen is still, like, you know, it's full of angst and all kinds of stuff. And I try really hard to let go and sit. But then at the same time, I'm working on these other aspects of practice. And as I recognize how hard I am on myself, I recognize how, you know, I'm holding up these much higher standards for myself than I would hold for anyone else. And I just abuse myself inside. I don't do this anymore, but I did at the time, abuse myself inside viciously and meanly about what a failure I am. And when I, you know, I saw that and I worked on it and I moved to this place of, like, screw that. Like, I'm just as, I deserve just as much consideration as anybody else. Like, there was a shift in my attitude. And my zazen was more still. Like, you know, if you heal these things, you take care of these things, you untangle some of this karma, then the zazen becomes more still, and then we might be more open to this insight that we are trying to invite. I mean, in a way, that whole self thing is an insight too, right? So pause there for questions or comments. Jinryu.
I really appreciate, I mean, first, everything you've been talking about tonight, but that very last thing you said, which I won't even try to paraphrase, but this whole point of getting to, I guess, unconditional acceptance of self. Mm. Because I, you know, I'll start there. I find it very difficult to practice this with people out there, if you know what I mean, who are not Buddhists. Mm. And my practice is getting me closer and closer to the point where I care less. And I don't mean this in a scornful way, but I care much less about what people think of me than I used to. However, you know, if someone judges me falsely, and by that I mean they just don't get it. You know, they think I'm kidding. You know, I was telling some friends about the fundraiser. Aren't you proud of yourself? Aren't you proud of yourself? This has nothing to do with me. That has everything to do with everybody else who's donating this money. Oh, yeah, right. Like, you're not human unless you have an ego this big. When what I'm really trying to practice on is getting my ego down to about the size of a walnut, just to where it's useful, but not, you know, doesn't get in the way. So I don't know if you can comment on that. I mean, I find, on the one hand, I'm at the point where I care less about what people think of me. On the other hand, as long as they think of me the right way, I'm fine. If they don't think of me the way I think they should think of me, then I'm, you know, do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. And honestly, this is I think another example of the whole like degrees of knowing. So you're making me think of how you know, so similarly, I used to be I would hide it, but I was incredibly sensitive to criticism, right? Just the slightest little implication that I wasn't the great person or something, then, you know, I'm just go and just stew over it and just think, oh, I should give up everything. And, you know, just totally, you know, and if somebody said something nice, I'm like, ah, you know, you don't really understand. Like, I'd blow off positive comments and just stew over negative ones. And there was this point of becoming much, much, I guess, you know, when we sit and we let go of everything and we let go of all aspects of ourselves, fundamentally, we do not have a name, we do not have a gender, we do not have a time. None of this is us. Those are all they're just details. That's not who we are. None of it is who we are. So who are we? We are just this. We're just this. And I can check in with this, and I can say, I did my best. And that's all I can do. And I know that's all I can do. I know I am okay. I did my best. I make you know, on the details level, I make mistakes. But like otherwise, I'm unfazed. I just take criticism as information. Oh, interesting. All right, well, maybe I can try to act differently. But it's not a comment on myself. On the same time, even though, you know, I have that, like you said, like it's a greater comfort. But if I am out in the world and somebody flips me off because they think I cut them off or whatever, I go, what, you know, just like you said, like, how dare you, like, I'm a good driver. It still arises. So it's like, what is that? It's like the insight has, you know, sunk this far, but it hasn't been completely imbibed yet. So I feel like that's our lifelong process, you know, of like how do we deepen that insight and make it even more pervasive so that it manifests more, you know, in more areas of our life. If someday I can meet that kind of, you know, thing in daily life with just like, oh, that's too bad. Did I do something wrong at that light back there? Then that will be true success. All right. So once again, we have a lot left in only 6 minutes. So let me just briefly talk about the great faith and great doubt and great faith. So I apologize for the many, many, many like little like samadhi, power, karma, relationship, all these terms and various things that I'm throwing out tonight. But here's another one. This is another way of looking at our practice. So you might think of all of this as like the Dharma. This is what Kyogen, one of my teachers, would say. The Dharma is like a tomato, and there are many different ways to slice it. So don't trouble yourself about like, well, wait a second, I thought there were, but there's 9 fields, but there's 2, there's what? It's just different ways to slice the tomato. So one way you can slice the tomato is thinking that we have, actually it's 3 parts, great faith, great doubt, and great determination. So great doubt is that, like I was saying, those questions, those recognizing our issues as koans, or asking ourselves, what more is there that I do not see? Always being open to that questioning, and honoring and valuing that questioning. If we think we're doing pretty cool, and then we hit a snag, or we start to feel uncomfortable or melancholy or whatever, what is that? So that doubt is engaging that very deliberately with mindfulness, and trying to be courageous about it as well. I think this is why the great doubt and great faith and great determination have to come together. Like they say, it's like 3 legs of a stool, and if it's only 2 legs, it'll fall over. So that doubt, we wouldn't have the courage, I think, I wouldn't have the courage to go into that question. You know, my self and emptiness of self, and seeking out my attachments, and, you know, looking in there deeply, swallowing that red hot iron ball. If I didn't have faith that it would be fruitful, I didn't have faith that there might be an answer, or that there would be a practice or a community or a teacher to help support me as I searched for the answer, that I wasn't just going to sink into despair or depression or overwhelm, or maybe even worse, just find out it really is just a big nihilistic void and I shouldn't have looked. But to say, no, actually this is a fruitful thing to do. There's reward, there's light at the end of the tunnel. There's reward for engaging these deeper questions. So we want to cultivate that faith at the same time, which we do by participating in Sangha, by the other fields of practice, and by through our own experience, because we can build that faith a little bit at a time. So it's like, if you've learned to practice mindfulness and it has allowed you a way to step outside of, you know, a panic attack, for instance, that's really good information, right? You're like, all right, that's cool. So then if something else is suggested, you might give that a try, and you might prove through your own experience that it is liberating and healthy and fruitful. So then, you know, you build up your courage and your faith a little bit through time to explore some things that are more challenging or a little bit scary. And then that great determination, which, you know, I guess that overlaps with what I was saying, that cultivating that spiritual urgency. And this is one I could probably do a whole class on this one, about not getting complacent, essentially, about always learning and growing, not being spiritually satisfied. So I just want to share with you this definition of samvega, which is this spiritual urgency, from Tenisaro Bhikkhu. Says it's a hard word to translate because it covers such a complex range. At least 3 clusters of feelings at once. The oppressive sense of shock, dismay, and alienation that comes with realizing the futility and meaninglessness of life as it's normally lived. A chastening sense of our own complicity, complacency, and foolishness in having let ourselves live so blindly. And an anxious sense of urgency in trying to find a way out of the meaningless cycle. And then that may sound a little negative, But I would guess that everyone has had a sense sometimes that that is kind of the flavor of life, especially if you look beyond, even if your own life is comfortable, but you look out into the wider world. Like, what? So, but again, this is the urgency. And then on the other side of it is saying there is a different way to be. We can find meaning. We can find our way out of that sense of meaninglessness. But at first, like, we have to admit that that's there. That is the honest response to our limitations, our lack of insight. Our honest response is saying, and that's a good thing. So if we use that in a positive way to motivate our practice, to fire up that great determination, then those three legs of the stool can come together. So we are at 9, but any questions, any burning questions that people want to get off your chest before we move on from cultivating insight? Hopefully that doesn't mean it was just too much. All right, I will say our closing verse. We offer the merit of this Sangha meeting to all so that they may be able to obtain the truth. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, Maha Prajna Paramita. Mm-hmm.